Amit stays where he is, chewing the inside of his lower lip and breathing hard through his nose, before tossing the tape in the trash and adjusting his pads. The last thing he sees before he goes through the door are words written in almost faded pencil on crumpled yellowed paper. A great deal is expected of anyone who's been given a lot. He joins the juniors at the center circle. In the middle of it is an image of a large, threatening bear. The emblem of the club. Strength, size, fear. Amit is the smallest person on the ice. He always has been. Ever since he was 8 years old, everyone has always told him that he won't be able to handle the next level. That he isn't tough enough, strong enough, big enough. But now he looks around him. Tomorrow this team is playing a semifinal game. They're one of the 4 best junior teams in the whole country. And he's here. He looks at Lit and Bobo, at Lars and David, at Benji and Kevin, and thinks that he's going to show them he can play. Even if it kills him. There's hardly anything that can make Peter feel as bad as hockey can. And, absurdly, there's hardly anything that can make him feel better. He keeps going over and over his situation until the air in his office seems to run out. When the frustration and nausea start to get unbearable, he gets up and goes out to sit in the stands. He usually thinks better there, so he sits there bouncing his ball up and down on the concrete for so long, he doesn't even notice the junior team start their training session down on the ice. Soon emerges from his office to get some coffee, and on the way back, he sees Peter sitting on his own in the stands. Soon knows that the GM is a grown man now, but it's hard for an old coach to stop thinking of his boys as boys. Soon has never told Peter he loves him. It can be just as hard for father figures to say that as it is for real fathers, but he knows how afraid Peter is of disappointing everyone. All men have different fears that drive them, and Peter's biggest one is that he isn't good enough. Not good enough as a dad, not good enough as a man, and not good enough as GM. He lost his parents and his firstborn child. And every morning he's terrified that he's going to lose Kira, Maya, and Leo. He couldn't bear losing his club as well. Soon sees him lift his head at last and look out across the juniors on the ice. Absent-mindedly to start with, he's so used to following this team now that he counts them without thinking about it. Soon remains standing in the shadows just so he can see Peter's face when the penny finally drops. For 10 years, Peter has helped shape this group of boys. He knows all their names, knows the names of all their parents. He ticks them off one by one in his mind to see if anyone's missing, if anyone might be injured. But they all seem to be there. In fact, there's actually one too many. He counts again. Can't make sense of it. Until he sees Amit. Shortest and slightest of them all, still in equipment that looks a bit too big, just like in his skating classes. Peter just stares. Then he starts to laugh out loud. He's been told so many times that the boy ought to stop playing, that he doesn't stand a chance, and now there he is, down on the ice. No one else has fought harder for this opportunity, and David is giving it to him today of all days. It's a small dream, nothing less. And Peter could do with a dream today. Soon nods with both joy and sadness as he sees this. He goes back to his office and closes his door. This evening he'll hold one of his last training sessions with the A-team, and when the season is over he'll go home and, deep down, we'll wish what we all wish whenever we leave something. That it's going to collapse. That nothing will work without us, that we're indispensable. But nothing will happen. The rink will remain standing. The club will live on. Amit adjusts his helmet and skates straight at an opponent, is checked and falls, but bounces up again. He gets hit and falls, but bounces up again. Peter leans back, smiling the way Kira says he only smiles when he's starting to fall asleep after a couple of grilled cheese sandwiches and half a glass of red wine. He allows himself 15 minutes in the stands before he goes back to his office, with his heart feeling much lighter. Fatima is standing in the washroom, stretching her back, slowly and carefully, so no one hears her whimpering in pain. Sometimes she quite literally rolls off the sofa bed in the morning because her muscles refuse to let her body sit up She hides it as well as she can. Always lets her son sit by the aisle on the bus so he's facing away from her when they stand up to get off and can't see the expression on her face. She discreetly lets the ends of the plastic bags in the trash cans at work hang so she doesn't have to bend down quite so far to get hold of them when she empties them. Every day she finds new ways to compensate. She apologizes as she creeps into Peter's office. If she hadn't, he would never have even heard her. Peter glances up from his papers, checks what time it is, and looks surprised. "But Fatima, what are you doing here now?" Horrified, she takes two steps back. "Sorry, I didn't mean to disturb you. I was just going to empty the trash and water the plants. I can come back when you've gone home." Peter rubs his forehead, laughs.
"Hasn't anyone told you?"
"Told me what?"
"About Amit."
Peter realizes far too late that you can't say something like that to a mother. She immediately assumes that her son has either been in a terrible accident or has been arrested. There's nothing neutral when you say, "Have you heard about your child?" to a parent. Peter has to take her gently by the shoulders and lead her through the hallway out into the stands. It takes her 30 seconds to realize what she's looking at. Then she claps her hands to her face and weeps. A boy training with the junior team, a head shorter than all the others. Her boy. Her back has never been straighter. She could run 1,000 miles. Chapter 13. The juniors are taking it easy. They've been told to play at 75%. No one wants any injuries before the game. Amit doesn't have that luxury. He throws himself into every situation, presses his skates down as hard as if he were trying to cut through to the concrete. He gets nothing for it. The juniors hack and trip him, force him into the boards, bring their sticks down on his wrists, and seek out every little weakness in every piece of equipment in order to hurt him. He gets cross-checked from behind, falls on all fours, sees lit skates swerve, and doesn't have time to shut his eyes before the shower of ice hits his cheeks. He doesn't hear a word from David. After 3/4 of an hour, Amit is so sweaty and exhausted and furious that it takes an epic exertion of will not to shriek, "Why am I here? Why did you bring me here if you're not going to let me play?" He hears them laughing behind his back. He knows that saying anything would only make them laugh even louder.
"I said as much, he's too weak,"
Lars snorts as Amit picks himself up off the ice for the 1,000th time. David looks at the time.
"Let's do some one-on-one, Amit against Bobo," he declares. "Are you kidding? Amit's done 2 training sessions in a row. He's on his last legs."
"Line them up," David replies bluntly. Lars shrugs and blows his whistle. David stays by the boards. He knows his views on hockey aren't entirely uncontroversial. He knows he has to keep on winning for the club to continue to let him play his way. But it's also the only thing he cares about. And there are no winners without losers. No stars are born without others in the collective being sacrificed. David's one-on-one training is simple. A line of cones is laid out on the ice from one end all the way to the other, forming a sort of corridor between them and the boards. One defenseman and one forward meet. If the puck leaves the corridor, the defenseman wins, so the exercise forces the forward to find a way to get past in a very confined space. Lars is setting the line up 7 or 8 yards from the boards, but David tells him to make it even narrower. Lars looks surprised, but does as he says. But then David gestures to him to make it even narrower. A couple of the juniors squirm uncomfortably but say nothing. In the end, it's so narrow that it's only a couple of yards wide, so narrow that Amit doesn't stand a chance of using his speed against Bobo. There's nowhere for him to escape. He has to meet him, body to body. Amit, some 90 pounds lighter than Bobo, can see this too. His thighs are screaming with lactic acid when he sets off with the puck. The exercise naturally presupposes a certain sporting distance between attacker and defender, but Bobo gives him none. He comes straight at him and hits him with all his weight. Amit lands on the ice like a sack of flour. Loud laughter from the bench. David gives a slight gesture to indicate that they should do it again.
"Stand up like a man!" Lars shouts.
Amit adjusts his helmet, tries to breathe normally. Bobo approaches faster this time. Ahmet's vision goes black for a moment, and when he opens his eyes again over by the boards, he's not quite sure how he ended up there. He can't hear the laughter from the bench anymore, just a muffled echo in his ears. He gets to his feet and collects the puck. Bobo slams him in the chest with his stick. It's like hitting a low-hanging branch at full speed.
"Get up!"
Lars roars. Ahmet crawls to his knees. There's blood dripping from his mouth. He realizes he must have bitten his lip or tongue, or both. Bobo is leaning over him, but no longer cruelly. Almost concerned this time. A glimpse of sympathy in his eyes. Or at least humanity.
"What the hell, Ahmet?"
"Just lie there. Don't you get it? This is what David wants? This is why you're here?" Ahmet glances toward the bench. David is standing there with his arms folded, calmly waiting. Even Lars looks concerned now. And only then does Ahmet realize what Bobo means. The only thing that matters to David is winning. And only teams with self-confidence win big games. So what do? The day before the biggest game ever? You let them bulldoze something weaker. Ahmet isn't here as a player. He's here as a sacrifice.
"Just stay lying down," Bobo tells him.
Ahmet disobeys him. "Again," he whispers, his thighs trembling. When Bobo doesn't reply, Ahmet hits the ice with his stick and roars, "Again!" He shouldn't have done that. The whole bench hears him. He hasn't given Bobo a choice. The back's eyes darken.
"Okay, whatever you want, stupid idiot."
Ahmet sets off. Bobo waits toward the center, forcing him out toward the boards. And as Ahmet skates, Bobo ignores the puck altogether and goes straight for his body. Ahmet's head hits the boards. He collapses onto the ice, and it takes him 10 seconds before he can even get to his knees.
"Again?"
Bobo growls through gritted teeth. Ahmet doesn't answer. He leaves a small trail of blood behind him as he goes over to the far blue line, collects the puck, and straightens up. He sees Bobo's body tense as he circles threateningly across the bear in the center circle and into the corridor of cones to put an end to this, once and for all. "Like a man," Ahmet thinks to himself. "Like a man." He shouldn't have the energy to take off the way he does. He ought to refuse to skate straight at Bobo after the beating he's taken. But at a certain point in a person's life, you either sink or swim, and nothing really matters anymore. What else could they do to him now beyond this? Fuck them. Bobo heads toward him at full speed, but at the very last instant, Ahmet doesn't stand up like a man. He folds himself double. When he sees Bobo's skates change angle, he slips the puck between them and nimbly spins his body out of and away from the check. In one stride, he's past Bobo. In two, he's caught up with the puck. In three, he's inside the offensive zone. He hears Bobo crash into the boards behind him, but now he only has eyes for the goalie. He pulls the puck off to the right, left, right, and waits for the goalie to move sideways, waits, 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 and when he finally sees the goalie's skates tilt a quarter of an inch, he shoots mid-skate into the opposite corner, against the flow. A lion among bears. Bobo sets off in blind fury, all the way from the other side of the rink. He's one of the worst skaters on the team, but when he reaches Ahmet with his stick raised, he still has enough speed and weight advantage to put the boy in the hospital. Bobo doesn't hear the sound of skates approaching rapidly from off to one side behind him, so the pain in his jaw when the shoulder hits it is jarring. Ahmet slumps in exhaustion some distance away, untouched. Bobo lies on his back on the ice, blinking up at the lights as Benji's face leans over him. "That's enough, Bobo," he says. Bobo nods stiffly. Benji helps him up and then ruefully rubs his own shoulder. The sound of a puck hitting the net can be the most wonderful sound in the world when you're 15. When you're 32, as well. "Write him up for tomorrow," David says as he leaves the bench. When the juniors head off to the locker room, Ahmet is still lying on the ice. Lars's voice reaches him through a milky haze.
"Gather up the pucks and cones. I usually tell the guys that there's a fuck embargo the night before a game, but there's no chance of you getting a fuck, so just lay off the wanking, because you're playing tomorrow.
It takes the boy an hour to half crawl, half stagger to the locker room. It's empty. The heating has been switched off. His shoes have been shredded, and his clothes are lying soaking wet on the floor of the shower. It's the best day of his life. Chapter 14. It's Saturday, and everything is going to happen today. All the very best, and all the very worst. The time is 5:45 in the morning, when Maya is hunting through the kitchen cupboards in search of painkillers. She goes back to bed feeling feverish and full of snot, and curls up next to Anna. She's almost asleep when Anna kicks her and mutters sleepily,
"Play for me."
"Be quiet."
"Play for me."
Maya grunts. "All right, I've got a question for you. Always hear me play the guitar every time you ask me to, or have me not kill you with it." Anna sulks in silence for a long time. Then she gently touches Maya's thigh with her permanently ice-cold toes.
"Please."
So Maya gives up and starts playing. Because Anna loves falling asleep to the sound of the guitar, and because Maya loves her. The last thing Maya thinks before she, too, falls asleep with her headache and cough is that it feels like she ought to spend the day in bed. The yard lies in thick darkness as Peter parks the little car outside the garage, beside the last building before the town stops and the forest takes over to the west. He slept for 3 anxious hours and woke up feeling overwhelmed. Hogg, his childhood friend, is standing in a poorly lit workshop bent over the engine of a Ford so old that it looks like it needs magic rather than a wrench. He's always been known as Hogg, because he played like a wild boar. He's the same height as Peter, but looks twice as wide. His stomach may have softened a little since their hockey years, but his arms and shoulders still look hard enough to have been beaten out of steel. He's wearing a t-shirt even though the garage door is open, and shakes Peter's hand, unconcerned about the fact that Peter doesn't have anything with which to wipe off the sticky mixture of oil and dirt left on his skin. Hogg is well aware that the sticky mess will drive his friend mad.
"Thought Kia said you were going to drop it off yesterday,"
he says, grinning at the car. "I was," Peter admits, doing his best not to think about the mess on his fingers. Hogg lets out a dry laugh, hands him a rag, and scratches his beard, which is so thick and unkempt it started to look like a shaggy ski mask.
"Annoyed?"
"Let's just say she wasn't exactly over the moon," Peter confesses.
"Do you want coffee?"
"Have you got any fresh?" Hogg chuckles.
"Fresh coffee. Have you gone all soft now? There's some instant in the kettle in the corner."
"I think I'll leave it." Hogg pats his hand intentionally as he walks past, and Peter wipes it with an irritated smile. Friends for 40 years, still the same joke. Hogg grabs a flashlight and heads out into the yard, and Peter stands next to him shivering, full of the sense of inadequacy that only afflicts a man of a certain generation when he watches another man from the same generation repair his wife's car. Hogg straightens up and spares Peter any technical jargon.
"Piece of crap. Bobo can do it when he wakes up. You can come pick it up at 9.
He goes back into the garage and absentmindedly picks up one of the Ford's heavy tires, making it look about as challenging as it is for Peter to put paper in the recycling bin. Bobo has unfortunately inherited both his father's raw strength and indifferent skating abilities. Hogg was a terrifying defensive player in his day, but soon always used to sigh,
"That lad even manages to trip over the blue lines."
"Maybe you could let Bobo have a bit of a rest today? Big game this afternoon," Peter says.
Hogg raises an eyebrow without looking up, then wipes his hand across his face to get rid of the sweat, leaving glossy streaks of oil in his beard.
"It'll take 2 hours to fix your car. If you're picking it up at 9, Bobo won't have to start until 7. That's a rest."
Peter opens his mouth but says nothing. A game of hockey is a game of hockey, but tomorrow this family will have to get up and earn a living again. Bobo is a solid back, but nowhere near a professional standard. There are 2 younger kids in the family, and the global economy waits for no man. Bears shit in the woods, and everyone shits on Beartown. Hog offers him a lift home, but he's happy to walk. Needs to calm his nerves. He walks past the factory, which provides work for fewer and fewer people. He passes the big supermarket, which has put all the smaller stores out of business. He turns onto the road leading to the center of town, and then onto the main shopping street. The street gets shorter and shorter every year. Ramona has survived long enough to get her pension, but one of the good things about owning your own pub is that no one can force you to stop working. The bearskin has been hers since it stopped being her mother's, and before that it belonged to her grandfather. It still looks much the same, but grandfather used to smoke indoors, and now Ramona smokes outside. 3 before breakfast, she lights the last of them on the dying stub of the second. The boys who play billiards and drink beer on a tab here every evening affectionately call her the Marlboro Mom. She has no children of her own. Holger couldn't have any, and perhaps never needed them either. The only family he wanted, apart from Ramona, was his sporting family, he used to say. Someone once asked him if there was any sport he didn't like, and he replied, "Politics. They should stop showing that on TV." If the house had been on fire, he'd have rescued Ramona, first of all. But she'd have had to be clutching their Beartown ice hockey season tickets when he did so. It was theirs, that ridiculous sport. All his loudest laughter and warmest embraces had been left behind in the stands. She was the one who smoked, he was the one who got cancer. "I'm suffering from an ironic illness," he declared breezily. Ramona refuses to let anyone say that he died. She says he left her, because that's how she sees it. Like a betrayal. She's been left standing in the snow like a bare tree trunk without any bark, unprotected now that he's no longer here. She has learned how to make the days pass. You just do. When the shift at the factory gets out in the afternoon, the bearskin fills with young men she calls the boys, and whom the police and the hockey club call far worse things. They're capable of a lot of crap, but they love Ramona the way Holger loved her. Maybe she's a bit too protective of them. She knows that. Beartown nurtures tough people, and the way life has turned out hasn't made her boys any softer. But they're all she has left of him. As close to her memories as she can bear to go. Death does strange, incomprehensible things to loving souls. She still lives in the apartment above the pub. Some of the boys who drive forklifts over in the supermarket warehouse buy food for her there now that the little store across the road is closed down. So the old woman no longer goes any farther than the ashtray outside the door. 11 years have passed since Holger left her, and at every A-team game, even when the rink is sold out, there are always 2 empty seats in the stands. Peter sees her from a long way off. She waits for him to get closer. "Are you looking for something, sir?" Ramona asks. She's gotten older, but she's like her pub. Always the same. The people who don't like the fact that the bearskin offers a refuge to the town's thugs each evening talk about her as an unpleasant, sociopathic old woman who's losing her marbles. But even if Peter hardly ever sees her these days, it still feels like coming home after a long journey each time he does. "Don't know yet," he smiles. "Nervous about the game?" He doesn't have to answer. She stubs her 3rd cigarette out under her shoe, tucks the butt inside the packet, and says, "Whiskey?" He looks up at the sky. Soon the town will wake up, and even the sun seems to be planning an early appearance. Everyone will wake up to the dream that a junior team game can change everything. Can it make the council turn its gaze toward the forest again? Set up a hockey academy? Maybe even build a shopping center? Make it so people giving directions say, "Stay on the road, past head," instead of, "If you get to Beartown, you've gone too far"? Peter has spent so long convincing other people of all that, he no longer knows if he believes it himself. "A cup of coffee would be good," he says. She lets out a hoarse chuckle and maneuvers herself down the steps into the pub. That's always the way with sons of fathers who liked whiskey a little too much. You either drink it all the time or not at all. There's no in-between in some families. Peter went to the bearskin more times before he turned 18 than he's been since. He usually had to carry his dad home. Sometimes he had to help him beat up a debt collector from head while he was at it. The bar looks the same now as it did back then. Smells a bit less of smoke. And considering what else a basement bar can smell of instead, that isn't altogether a good thing. It's empty now, of course. Peter never comes here in the evening. It isn't a healthy environment for the GM of an underperforming A-team. The old men in the bar have always had a lot to say, but the younger men sometimes go further than harsh words these days. There's a constant threat of violence hidden just beneath the surface of a certain type of person in this town that Peter never noticed when he was growing up, but which struck him all the more plainly after he came home from Canada. Neither hockey, nor school, nor the economy ever managed to find a way out for these people. And they emanate a silent fury. They're known as the Pack now, even if no one ever hears them say that themselves. The team's official supporters club has always been called Ursus Arctos, and technically the men who hang out at the Bearskin belong to nothing but that, along with the pensioners, preschool teachers, and parents of young families in the seats in the stands. The Pack has no membership cards or t-shirts. The town is small enough for big secrets, but Peter knows that even when they are at their strongest, there are never more than 30 or 40 of them. Yet that's enough to require extra police at A-team games in order to guarantee security. Players who have been recruited from other towns and are thought not to have performed well enough on the ice in comparison to their paycheck have occasionally shown up in Peter's office out of the blue, wanting to tear up their contracts and move. Reporters from the local paper ask questions one day and are inexplicably uninterested the following morning. The Pack has scared their opponents away from coming to Beartown, but sadly the same thing applies to sponsors. The 20-something men at the Bearskin have become the most conservative people in town. They don't want a modern Beartown, because they know that a modern Beartown won't want them. Ramona pushes the cup of coffee across the bar, then knocks on the wood.
Is there something you need to talk about?
Peter scratches his head. The Marlboro mom was always Beartown's preeminent psychologist, even if her standard prescription was usually, pull yourself together, there's others who've got it worse.
I've just got a lot on my mind, that's all.
He looks at the walls, covered with game jerseys and pictures of players, pennants, and scarves.
When did you last see a game, Ramona?
I haven't seen one since Holger left me. You know that, son.
Peter turns the cup between his fingers, reaches for his wallet. When Ramona waves her hand dismissively, he puts the money down on the bar anyway.
If you don't want it for the coffee, you can always put it in the kitty.
She nods appreciatively and takes the notes. The kitty is a box she keeps in her bedroom. She uses it to help when one of the boys loses his job and can't pay the bills.
The person who needs it right now is someone from your old line. Robert Holtz has lost his job at the factory. He's spending too much time here.
Oh, shit,
Peter says, because he doesn't know what else to say. He had meant to call Robbie from Canada. He had meant to call him when he moved home. Good intentions don't count. 20 years is too long for him to know how to start the conversation now. Should he apologize? What for? How? His eyes roam across the walls again.
Hockey, he says. Do you ever think about what a strange sport it is, Ramona? The rules, the rink. Who on earth would come up with something like that?
Someone who needed to give drunk men with rifles a less dangerous hobby? The aged landlady suggests.
I just mean, damn. This might sound a bit crazy, but sometimes you can't help wondering if we don't take all this a bit too seriously. If we aren't putting too much pressure on the juniors. They're not really much more than kids.
Ramona pours herself a glass of whiskey. Breakfast is, after all, the most important meal of the day.
That depends what we want from the kids. And what the kids want from hockey.
Peter clutches his cup tighter.
And what do we want, Ramona? What can the sport give us? We devote our whole lives to it, and what can we hope to get, at best? A few moments? A few victories? A few seconds when we feel bigger than we really are? A few isolated opportunities to imagine that we're immortal? And it's a lie. It really isn't important.
Silence settles between them, untouched. Only when Peter pushes his empty cup back across the bar and stands up to leave, does the old widow drain her glass and grunt.
The only thing the sport gives us are moments. But what the hell is life, Peter, apart from moments. The best psychologist in town. Kira gathers together Leo's pads and folds his laundry and packs his bag and puts it in the hall. He's 12. He ought to do his own packing. She knows that. But she also knows that she's the one who has to drive him to practice and will have to come straight back to pick up half his things if he packs for himself. When she's done, she sits down at the computer for half an hour. When Leo was at primary school, his teacher once told him during a parent consultation what he had said when he was asked what his parents did.
My dad works with hockey. My mom writes emails.
She puts the coffee on, ticks a number of things off her lists and on her calendar, takes several deep breaths, and feels the heaviness in her chest. Panic attacks, the psychologist said 6 months ago, and Kira never went back after that. She felt ashamed. As if life wasn't happy enough, as if she wasn't content. How could she possibly explain that to her family? Panic attacks. What did that even mean? A lawyer, wife of the GM, hockey mom, and God knows she loves being all three of those. But sometimes she stops the car in the forest going one way or the other and sits in the darkness, crying. She remembers her own mother on those occasions, the way she would wipe the tears from her children's cheeks and whisper, "No one ever said life was going to be easy." Being a parent makes you feel like a blanket that's always too small. No matter how hard you try to cover everyone, there's always someone who's freezing. She wakes Leo at 8. His breakfast is already on the table. She'll be driving him to practice in half an hour. Then she'll come home and pick up Anna and Maya so that the three of them can do a voluntary shift in the cafeteria during the juniors' game. Afterward, Leo will need driving to a friend's and Maya to one of hers, presumably. Then Kira hopes Peter will get back from the office in time for them to have a glass of wine together. Maybe some heated-up lasagna from the freezer, before he falls asleep from exhaustion and she sits up till midnight answering emails in an inbox that never empties. Tomorrow is Sunday, and there will be hockey clothes to wash and bags to be packed and teenagers to be woken. Then back to work on Monday, and work, quite honestly, has been shit recently. Since she turned down the offer of promotion, the demands on her have, ironically enough, gotten worse. She knows she's only allowed to arrive last each morning and leave first in the afternoon because she's the best at what she does. But it's been a long time since she felt she was the best she could be. She doesn't have time. She's not up to it. When the kids were little, she saw so many other parents lose control in the stands at the rink, and she couldn't understand them. But now she does. The children's hobbies aren't only the children's hobbies. The parents put just as many hours into them, year after year, sacrificing so much, paying out such huge amounts of money, that their significance eats its way even into adult brains. They start to symbolize other things, compensating for or reinforcing the parents' own failures. Kira knows it sounds silly. She knows it's just a silly game and a silly sport. But deep down, she's nervous too, as well as feeling nervous on behalf of Peter and the juniors and the club and the town today. Deep down, she could also do with winning at something. She goes past Maya's room, picks up some clothes from the floor, and when her daughter whimpers in her sleep, she puts her hand on her forehead. It's hot. In a couple of hours, Kira will be surprised by the fact that her daughter voluntarily and almost eagerly insists on going with them to the rink, regardless. She usually plays the martyr as hard as she can if she finds so much as a split end in order to have an excuse not to have to go to hockey. In hindsight, Kira will wish 1,000 times over that she had forced her daughter to stay at home. Chapter 15. There are plenty of things that hurt people without people ever really knowing why. Anxiety can act as internal gravity, shrinking the soul. Benji has always been good at falling asleep and bad at actually sleeping. He wakes up early on the day of the game, but not from nerves. That's never bothered him. He cycles away from home before his mom wakes up, leaves his bike at the edge of the forest, and walks the last few miles to Adri's kennels. He sits in the yard patting the dogs until his other two sisters, Katya and Gabby, also show up. They kiss their little brother on the top of his head. Then their elder sister comes out and slaps him hard on the back of the neck with her open hand and asks if it's true that he called his teacher Sweet Cheeks.
He never lies to Audrey. She slaps him on the back of the neck again, then kisses him just as hard and whispers that she loves him and that she'll never let anything bad happen to him, but that she'll kill him if she hears he's spoken to a teacher like that again. The four of them eat breakfast surrounded by dogs, without saying anything much. They do this once a year, a quiet act of remembrance, always early in the morning so their mother doesn't find out about it. She's never forgiven her husband. Benji was too little when it happened to harbor any hatred, and his three sisters are somewhere in between. Everyone has their own struggle. When Benji gets to his feet, he doesn't ask any of them to go with him, and they don't ask where he's going. They just kiss his hair one after the other, tell him he's an idiot, and that they adore him. He walks back through the snow to his bicycle, then goes off to the cemetery, where he crouches down with his back against Alan Ovich's headstone, smoking joints until the pain is soft enough to let his tears start to fall. The boy's fingertips trace the worn lettering of the name on the stone. On this day, 15 years ago, early one March morning, Alan got out his hunting rifle before his family woke up. Then he took everything that hurt him and went straight out into the forest. It doesn't matter how many times you explain it to a child. No one loses a parent that way without knowing that all the other grown-ups are lying when they say, "It wasn't your fault." People feel pain, and it shrinks their souls. The minutes are creeping toward lunchtime. Kevin is standing in the garden dribbling a puck with soft, controlled movements and complicated patterns between 40 glass bottles placed around the ice. To anyone else, it would have looked like it was happening incredibly fast, but to him, each movement of his wrist feels leisurely. Time moves slower for him than other people. He doesn't know why. When he was little, he used to get beaten up by the older kids because he was too good, until Benji showed up out of nowhere at training one day. They slept at each other's houses every day for several months, read Benji's sister's old superhero comics by flashlight under the covers, and both their lives suddenly made sense. Their own superpowers united them. "Sweetheart," Kevin's mom calls from the terrace door, pointing at her watch. As Kevin approaches, she carefully reaches out her hand and brushes some snow from his shoulder, lets her hand rest there for longer than usual, more gently than he's used to. She bites her lower lip. "Are you nervous?" Kevin shakes his head. She nods proudly. "We need to go. Your dad managed to get us on an earlier flight to Madrid. We'll drop you off at the rink. You'll have time to watch the first period, though?" He can see in her eyes that she's going to pieces, but she'd never admit it. "We're in a hurry, sweetheart. Your dad's got an important meeting with a client." "It's a round of golf," Kevin snaps. That's as close as he ever gets to answering back. His mother doesn't reply. Kevin knows it's pointless to carry on. The main hobby of this household isn't hockey, it's avoiding any talk about feelings. If you raise your voice, you lose. All you get is a curt, "There's no point talking to you if you're just going to shout," followed by a door closing somewhere in the house. He starts to walk toward the hall. His mother hesitates, reaches her hand out to his shoulder again, but stops herself and touches him tenderly on the neck instead. She runs a large company and is very popular among her staff precisely because she's so approachable and sympathetic. It's as if it's easier when the people involved have different job descriptions. For years, she used to go to bed dreaming of all the things she was going to do when she got older and had more time, and now she sometimes wakes up in despair in the middle of the night because she can no longer remember what those things were. She wanted to give Kevin everything she herself never had as a child, and she always thought she'd have time left over for all the other stuff. Talking and listening. The years have passed too quickly, and somewhere between her work and Kevin's hockey practice, he grew up. She never managed to learn how to communicate with her child, and now that she has to tilt her head back to look him in the eye, it's even harder. "We'll come to the final," she promises, the way only a mother can when she inhabits a world where it would be inconceivable for a final to take place without her son being part of it. The cafeteria is still empty, even if the rink is beginning to fill with people. Kira is making coffee and getting hot dog rolls out of the freezer. Maya is gazing out of the window.
Who are you looking for?
Anna teases. Maya gives her a hard stare, and Anna cups her hands in front of her mouth and imitates a crackly cockpit announcement.
Ladies and gentlemen, we ask you not to open any snacks during this flight because we have someone suffering from a peanut allergy on board.
Maya kicks her in the shin. Anna jumps out of the way and goes on in the same voice.
We may let you lick the salt from the peen.
Kira sees everything, hears everything, and understands almost everything, but says nothing. It's impossible to let your daughter grow up. The only problem is that you're not given a choice. Kira was 15 once upon a time, and unfortunately still remembers exactly the sort of thing that used to fill her head back then. I'm just going to get the milk from the car, she interrupts when she suspects that Anna is about to say something that neither mother nor daughter are ready to hear spoken out loud in each other's company. Kevin's father is already sitting in the car, and he tells Kevin to sit in the front and starts to quiz him about his English test on Monday. His father's life is all about the quest for perfection, his whole life a chessboard where he isn't happy unless he's 2 moves ahead of everyone else. Success is never a coincidence. Luck can give you money, but never success, he often says. His ruthlessness in business frightens people, but Kevin has never seen him raise his hand to anyone, or even his voice. He can actually be quite charming when he wants, without ever needing to reveal anything about himself. He never loses control, never gets excited, because you just don't if you're always living in the future. Today there's a hockey game, but on Monday there's an English test. 2 moves ahead. My job is to be your father, not your friend, his dad explained when Kevin mentioned once too often the fact that Benji's mother sees almost all of their games. He didn't need to get angry for Kevin to understand his point. Benji's mother doesn't sponsor the team to the tune of several million kroner every year. She doesn't make sure that the lights in the rink stay on. So she probably has rather more time to watch games. Benji has taken the road by the lake so he can smoke without anyone seeing, which ought to stop Lit's mother from organizing another petition the way she did when they were at preschool and Lit saw Benji eating sweets even though it wasn't a Saturday. She's very keen on justice and equality, Lit's mother, so long as they're based on her precise interpretation of those words. Almost all the parents are like that. Benji has always thought that this town must be a terrible place to be a grown-up. He buries the butt of his joint in the snow, then stands among the trees with his eyes closed, and contemplates turning around and walking back the way he came, away from all this. Then maybe steal a car and leave Bear Town in the rearview mirror. He wonders if that would make him happier. The parking lot in front of the rink is full of people. Kevin's dad stops the car a short distance away. We haven't got time to stop and talk today, he says, nodding toward the other sponsors and parents in the parking lot, who are as impressed by the Erdahl family's money as their kids are by the way Kevin plays hockey. When you grow up in a family that never talks about feelings, you learn to hear the nuances in words like that. There's no need for him to apologize to Kevin for not driving him all the way to the door, because he just did. They pat each other briefly on the shoulder, and Kevin gets out. You can tell us all about it tomorrow, his dad says. There are dads who ask, did you win? But Kevin's asks, how many did you win by? Kevin always hears him making notes. A whole section of the basement of the house consists of neatly stacked boxes packed with thick notepads full of careful statistics from every game Kevin has ever played, all the way back to Little League. There are probably people who think it's wrong to ask your son, how many goals did you score, instead of, did you score any goals? But both Kevin's father and Kevin himself would have replied the same way. How many goals did their son score? Kevin doesn't ask his father if they'll have time to watch the first period. He just shuts the door and hoists his bag onto his shoulder, as if this were just an ordinary Saturday. But as the car pulls away, he turns and watches it until it's gone. There are more parents than players around him in the parking lot. This isn't just an ordinary Saturday for them. Kevin's mom turns around for some reason and looks through the back window. She usually doesn't do that. Like her husband, she places great value on not being sentimental and teaching Kevin to be independent. They've watched spoiled children in the Heights grow up to become triumphs of mediocrity, feeble, whining creatures who are going to need their hands held all their lives. And they're not going to let that happen to Kevin. even when it hurts. Even when Kevin had to walk all the way back from head in the dark when he was in primary school, because his dad wanted to teach him the consequences of being late. Even when his mother had to pretend to be asleep when the boy got home. Even when she wept silently into her pillow. What feels comfortable for the parents isn't what's best for the child. She's convinced of that. And Kevin has grown strong because they've allowed him to. But Kevin's mother will always remember what she sees through the rear window that Saturday, and how her son looks as he stands in the parking lot. On the biggest day of his life, he is the loneliest boy on earth. Amit tries to make it look like he's only walking past the cafeteria by chance, and succeeds pretty much as well as if he'd tried to claim he'd eaten his best friend's ice cream by mistake. Kira is heading in the opposite direction, but greets him cheerily and says far too loudly, "Hi, Amit. Are you looking for Maya?" Kira gestures brightly toward the cafeteria and disappears down the stairs, but turns back and calls, "Good luck today." Then she tenses her muscles and growls dramatically, the way she's heard teenagers do out in the town when they wish each other luck. "Knock 'em dead." Amit smiles bashfully. In the cafeteria, Anna and Maya's voices grow louder in heated debate, and Kira hurries down the stairs before one of the girls says something about boys that her mother would have to scrub away from her brain with soap, water, and copious amounts of Riesling. Benji is suddenly standing next to Kevin without Kevin having heard him arrive, his hand on his friend's shoulder, and not a word about the fact that Kevin's eyes look shiny. In return, Kevin says nothing about anniversaries and cemeteries. They've never needed to. They just look each other in the eye and say the only thing they always say before a game. "What's the second coolest thing in the world, Kev?" When Kevin doesn't respond at once, Benji elbows him in the stomach. "What's the second coolest thing in the world, hotshot?" "Fucking," Kevin says, smiling. "But first, you have to go into that rink and do the coolest thing in the world," Benji cries, swinging his bag so carelessly that Kevin has to duck. As they head off toward the locker room, Kevin raises his eyebrows and asks, "So, Benjamin, have you been to the bathroom?" When they were little, during one of their very first matches together, Benji wet himself on the team bench. Not because he couldn't get to the bathroom, but because one of the players on the opposing team had been trying to check Kevin all through the game, and Benji refused to leave the bench and risk missing a changeover and leaving Kevin unprotected. Benji bursts out laughing, as does Kevin. Then they pick up their sticks and set off to go and do the coolest thing in the world. Have you heard any of their new tracks, though? They're completely insane. It's like you get high just from listening, Anna squawks. "What is it you don't get? I don't like techno," Maya cries. "This isn't techno. It's house," Anna snaps, insulted. "Whatever. I like music where they can play at least one instrument and with lyrics that contain more than 5 words. "God, when are you going to listen to music that isn't a suicide soundtrack?" Anna wonders, letting her hair fall over her face and imitating Maya's music taste with drawn-out air guitar strumming and groaned lyrics. "I'm so sad, wanna die, because my music sucks." Maya laughs loudly and counters with one fist gyrating in the air and the other on an invisible laptop. "Okay, this is your taste in music. Oomph, oomph, oomph. Drugs! Yeah! Oomph, 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 oomph." Beside them, Amit clears his throat. By now, they're bouncing around the cafeteria so uncontrollably that Anna knocks over a whole stack of boxes of gummy bears. Maya stops, howling with laughter. "Are you okay?" Amit asks. "We just have very, very different tastes in music," Maya grins. "Okay, I was just passing. I might be playing today," Amit says. Maya nods. "I heard. Congratulations." "Well, I'll probably be on the bench most of the time, but I'm on the team. But if you're not doing anything afterward, later, I mean, this evening, or if you are doing something, then I thought maybe I'd ask if you like, with me." Anna slips on 2 packets of candies and very nearly brings down the entire soda fountain. Maya is laughing so hard she's almost sick. "Sorry, Amit, what did you say?" Amit is about to reply, but isn't quick enough. Suddenly, Kevin is standing next to him, not bothering to pretend that he just happened to be passing by. He's here because of Maya. She stops laughing when she sees him.
Hi, he says.
Hi, she says. Your name is Maya, isn't it? She nods warily, looks him up and down.
Yes.
What's your name? It takes Kevin a few seconds to realize that she's joking. Everyone in Beartown knows his name. He laughs. Ephraim von Shitmagnet, at your service. He bows theatrically, even though he hardly ever makes jokes. And she laughs. Amit stands alongside, hating the fact that it's the best sound he knows. And it's not for him. Kevin looks at Maya in fascination.
We're having a team party at my place tonight to celebrate our victory. My parents are away.
Maya raises a skeptical eyebrow.
You seem very sure you're going to win.
Kevin looks like he doesn't understand.
I always win.
Really? You do you? Ephraim the Shit Magnet? Maya laughs.
Von Shit Magnet, please. Kevin grins. Maya laughs. Anna crawls to her feet and adjusts her hair awkwardly.
Will Benji be there at the party?
Maya kicks her on the shin. Kevin nods cheerily at Maya.
There, you see? Bring your friend. It'll be cool.
Then he turns toward Amit for the first time and exclaims, You'll come too, won't you? I mean, you're part of the team now. Amit tries to look self-assured. Kevin's 2 years older, and that's crushingly obvious as they're standing next to each other.
Can I bring a friend too? He asks quietly.
Sorry, Ahmed. This is just for the team, yeah?
Kevin replies, slapping him on the back. My name's Amit, Amit says, but Kevin has already walked off. Maya and Anna go back into the cafeteria, still laughing. Amit is left alone in the corridor. If he gets a single chance to make a decisive move in the match this evening, there's nothing he wouldn't give to make the most of it. Chapter 16. Pride in a team can come from a variety of causes. Pride in a place, or a community, or just a single person. We devote ourselves to sports because they remind us of how small we are, just as much as they make us bigger. Kira leaves the girls in the cafeteria, laughing in spite of herself. If Peter had heard the things she herself had said to her friends when she was 15, he'd have needed a defibrillator. They were so surprised by each other to start with. She told him he was the only prudish hockey player, and he covered his ears when she joked around with other bar staff. She was so used to being the only girl where she worked. It is the same in law firms as it had been in the restaurant, but testosterone has never been a problem for her. Peter was the one who needed a paper bag to breathe into when one A-team player, sans front teeth, once told Kira gleefully at one of the few team dinners the wives were still invited to that he had rubbed his knob on every fucking glass in here, in the hope that the GM's wife would be disgusted. She responded by explaining the female equivalent to him in great detail, until the toothless wonder didn't dare look at her again for the rest of the evening. Peter was ashamed at the time. Still is. The last, embarrassed Neanderthal. All these years, and they can still surprise each other. That's not such a bad thing. She walks toward the parking lot through the rink, but stops by the ice and just stares at it. No matter how much she tries, she will never be anything more than Peter's other half in this town. She assumes that all adults occasionally wonder about another life, one they could be living instead of the one they've got. How often they do so probably depends on how happy they are. Her mother always used to say her daughter was an incurable romantic as well as hopelessly competitive, both at the same time. Kira presumes that's true, based on the fact that she and Peter have gone bowling 3 times and are still married. The 3rd time, they ended up Googling emergency marriage counselor at 1:30 in the morning. God, how much he annoys her sometimes. But God, how she loves him. It wasn't a love that developed gradually. It hit her like an affliction. It's an ongoing condition. All she wishes is that each day were 48 hours long. But she's not greedy. She'd be happy with 36. She just wants to be able to have a drink and catch up with a TV show. Is that really too much to ask? She just wants sufficient time to make a big enough blanket. She thinks about that other life far too often, the one someone else is living. She was so happy for Peter when he got his professional contract, but she was happy for herself when he stopped playing, when there was space for her. Will she ever be able to admit that to him? The brief period when he was neither a player nor a GM, when he sold insurance and simply tried to be happy, is the best time she can remember. How can you tell the person you love something like that? When Isak died, everyone did everything for them. When their lungs collapsed, they needed a fabricated form of love that could help them breathe. So Kira made the hardest decision she has ever made. She realized she was going to have to give Haki back to Peter. There's a thin line between living and surviving, but there's one positive side effect of being both romantic and very competitive. You never give up. Kira gets the milk from the car, then stands there just laughing to herself, and realizes that she's learned to laugh that way more and more often. Then she takes out a green scarf emblazoned with the words, Bear Town Ice Hockey, and ties it around her neck. On her way back into the rink, she greets and hugs other people wearing the same color, and for a few moments, everything else seems unimportant. You don't need to understand every aspect of the ice to love it, and you don't have to love the town to feel proud of it. Peter is wandering around the rink like an exorcised ghost. His entire day so far has been a sequence of moments similar to walking into a room and instantly forgetting why you're there. In the hallway outside his office, he absentmindedly walks into Tails, which is no mean feat, seeing as there's a lot of Tails not to notice. He's 6.5 feet tall, and a good deal sturdier around the waist than when they played in the final of the Swedish championship together. He was always the sort of guy who compensated for a lack of self-confidence by trying to attract as much attention as possible. He talks as loudly as a child with headphones on, and when they were teenagers, he always turned up at parties in a suit when everyone else was wearing jeans, because he had read in a magazine that girls liked that. Toward the end of their time in high school, one of the club's sponsors died, and the whole team was told to wear suits for the funeral. When he heard that, he showed up in a tailcoat. And that was how he got his nickname. These days, he owns a chain of large supermarkets, one here and one in Head, and a couple more in places Peter has never really bothered to make a mental note of when Tails has been going on about them. He's managed to get thrown out of every hunting club in the area because he can't even keep quiet in the forest. When they played together, he would gesticulate with his long arms every time a call went against him, veering between laughter, tears, despair, and rage so quickly that Soon used to say it was like trying to coach a mime who can't shut up. Tails was a mediocre player, but he loved the competitive aspect of the game. When his hockey career came to an end, that attitude made him a far from mediocre salesman. Now he gets a new car every year and wears a Rolex the size of a blood pressure monitor. Trophies from a different sport. What a day, eh? The bulky grocer grins, gazing down at him. They are standing next to the old team photograph in which they're standing side by side. And now you're GM and I'm the main sponsor, Tails smirks in a way that stops Peter from pointing out that he's actually a long way from being the main sponsor. Yes, what a day, Peter agrees. We look out for each other, don't we? The Bears from Bear Town, Tails roars. And before Peter has time to respond, he goes on. I bumped into Kevin Erdahl yesterday. I asked him if he was nervous, and you know what he said? No. So I asked him what his tactics were for the game, and you know what he said? To win. Then he looked me right in the eye and said, that's why you sponsor the team, isn't it? To get a return on your investment. 17 years old. Did we talk that way when we were 17? Peter doesn't answer. He's not sure he can remember ever being as young as 17. He goes over to the coffee machine. It's gone wrong again and rattles and hisses before reluctantly emitting a dribble the color of old chewing tobacco and the consistency of glue. Peter drinks it anyway. Tails scratches himself under one of his chins and lowers his voice. We've met up with the counselors, some of us sponsors and board members, all off the record, of course. Peter is looking for cream and is trying to make it clear that he doesn't want to hear this. Tails takes no notice. When the juniors win the final, they're going to pick Beartown as the site of the hockey academy. It would look terrible if they didn't, in PR terms, of course. And we've had a bit of a discussion about renovating the rink. Also off the record, I assume, Peter grunts, seeing as he knows that off the record in the political language of the local council means backs being scratched with one hand while the other stuffs money into a pocket. Tails slaps him on the back and nods toward his office.
Who knows, Peter? Maybe we'll even be able to afford to get you an espresso machine.
Great, Peter mutters.
I don't suppose you've got anything strong.